Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to 1956, episode 2.17. Last time, our analysis of Eden's lack of friends and the worsening Suez crisis continued, as we also added in some Canadian flavour to the narrative. We last left Anthony Eden on the 5th of November, having learned that the Canadian Foreign Secretary Lester Pearson had successfully pushed for the UNEF resolution. As per the terms of this resolution, though, a ceasefire would have to be arranged first, which was a tad problematic since at that moment Anglo-French paratroopers were dropping over Port Said and Operation Musketeer was rolling into action. It only seemed logical then that President Eisenhower, having had enough of Eden's schemes, would demand a ceasefire be arranged before any face-saving measures be undertaken. Eden thus set himself a new task. He would have to recast the Anglo-French action not merely as a police action, but as a holding action. British and French soldiers, Eden would claim, had only arrived to hold peace together until the United Nations Emergency Force was ready to arrive. Time would tell if not merely the Americans, but also the political opposition of the House of Commons would let Eden away with this manipulation. Let's find out as I take you all to the House of Commons on the early afternoon of the 5th of November. Selwyn Lloyd had already had a long day before he had even made his way into the House of Commons on the afternoon of the 5th of November. The news was awash with bad tidings. The United Nations, alongside the United States, seemed to be on the verge of forcing a ceasefire and cutting the Anglo-French legs out from under them before they'd even got off the ground. Worse than that, one pillar of hope throughout the whole crisis, that the Egyptian government would fold or eject Nasser as soon as significant Anglo-French forces landed, were proved to be utterly false. By 1 p.m. GMT on the 5th of November, British and French paratroopers were engaging in a fierce battle with Egyptian defenders along a split of land in front of Port Said. This paradrop had been tasked with softening up the defenders and seizing key positions before the main bulk of the force arrived. Yet there was another hope that at first contact, a white flag would simply be waved, and these Egyptians would surrender unconditionally, removing any need to land any more soldiers at all. The Egyptian government would capitulate to Anglo-French demands, Nasser would be removed, and the Entente would have achieved its satisfaction before generously welcoming the United Nations Emergency Force into the Suez Canal, having achieved their objectives. This dreamlike scenario was still at the top of the Prime Minister's list of goals when the 5th of November began, and this explains his reluctance to call to a halt any military action for the moment. However, in the evening of the 5th of November, it was learned that the Egyptians would not be surrendering unconditionally, and that on the contrary, Nasser had instructed boxes of small arms to be placed on street corners with all able-bodied Egyptians welcome to help themselves and attack the invader. The 5th of November was thus a day which began and ended very differently, and in the middle of that day, when all answers were not yet available, Selwyn Lloyd would have to do his best to face the music which his peers planned to play. While Anthony Eden sat the debates out and dealt with matters of state, the Foreign Secretary would have to stand up for his master's policy, which we can guess that by that point he held very little stock in. Public and private meetings were very different things, though, and Lloyd would have to remain loyal to the man who had led him this far, lest he wanted disloyalty to be heaped upon the pile of his other sins, those sins being anxiety, manipulation, and carelessness. The 5th of November was also the day that more information was coming out about affairs in Hungary, where the Soviets had reinvaded Budapest and were in the process of trampling the revolutionary government there after promising not to do so many times before. Indeed, Lloyd would open the Commons debate by talking first about Hungary and then about the situation in Egypt and the recent resolution on an emergency force which had recently been approved by the UN General Assembly. After opening the discussion on Hungary by describing what had gone on there and what the British government had done to help the Hungarians, that help took the form of a mere £25,000 loan, for instance, Lloyd then sat back and faced some blistering responses. The first challenge came from Arthur Henderson, a Labour backbencher, who made an uncomfortable comparison for the Foreign Secretary, saying, Is the Foreign Secretary aware that many people in this and other countries will believe that the action of Her Majesty's government in using force against the people and government of Egypt offered a direct encouragement to the government of Russia to employ the brutal force that they did yesterday in Budapest to suppress the struggles of the Hungarian people for freedom and independence? This was followed by another request from another Labour MP, Alfred Robins, who made a good point when he asked, "The United Nations is calling on the Soviet government to desist from their intervention in Hungary and to withdraw their forces from that country. And as I have no doubt, the representative of the government of the United Nations will support the decision of the United Nations. Would it not be as well to carry out the United Nations decision on Egypt so that we can go to the United Nations with clean hands?" But the final challenge amidst the calls for Lloyd's resignation came from Labour MP Victor Collins, who asked, "Can the Foreign Secretary say whether, in principle, there is any difference between that and the Russian threat to the Hungarians, except that they gave 4 hours' notice and we gave 12 hours' notice? Is the Right Honourable and Learned Gentleman further aware that the Egyptian people were told not only the guilty few would suffer, but the innocent as well? Can he say whether the Egyptians were guilty of the same crime as the Hungarians, wanting to run their own country in their own way?" And it was the Labour MP Douglas Jay who captured the day's events best when he finished by asking the Foreign Secretary, "Has the Foreign Secretary noticed that the Russian Foreign Secretary has stated that Russia is carrying out a police action in Hungary? Does the Prime Minister realise that most of the British public regard him as personally guilty of this tragedy?" So Selwyn Lloyd was evidently in enemy territory, and he clearly lost a great deal of sympathy and goodwill from the opposition benches, who were tired of being lied to and not receiving proper answers. Just after 4 p.m, though, Lloyd was then to present the debate on the situation in the Middle East, which involved explaining the last few days' worth of debating in the UN General Assembly, and explaining why the British had abstained rather than voted for the resolution which established the UN Emergency Force. The General Assembly resolution passed anyway, of course, even with the British abstention, but this abstention was duly noted in the Commons, and shouts of shame were levelled at Lloyd as soon as he referred to it. Why had the British delegate elected to abstain rather than give his assent to the creation of a UN emergency force, especially when the British would support that force in the future? The first thing to remember is that, at the time of abstaining, it was still hoped that the Egyptians would capitulate to the Anglo-French forces that were soon to land. This would remove any need for any high-level UN interference, and Eden didn't want a potential victory to be snatched away, especially if this victory would do away with President Nasser. The second thing to remember is that the resolution calling for the establishment of a UN emergency force also called for a ceasefire and for all sides to pull back. The British delegate in the General Assembly at the time reasoned that these two ends were not compatible. If all sides pulled back and refrained from fighting, and the British and French forces left the region, how would the emergency force from the United Nations establish itself? Far better to keep the British and French armies on the ground in Suez so that they could maintain order until the emergency force arrived. Wouldn't this make sense? Well, while it might make a small amount of sense, everyone in opposition, and it seemed in other countries, could smell a rat. The British and French did not really wish to stay behind to keep the peace. They really wanted to stay behind to defeat the Egyptians, to cling to the canal and to ruin Nasser. This, Lloyd insisted, was simply not true, though, as he declared in the Commons. "It is the policy of Her Majesty's government to ensure that the Israel forces withdraw from Egyptian territory. We have also told the United Nations that we believe it is necessary to secure the speedy withdrawal of Israeli forces. But we cannot ensure that the Israelis withdraw from Egyptian territory until we are physically in the area to keep the peace, to give the necessary guarantees, and to prevent a repetition of the events of the last few years. There must also be immediate means on the spot to take the necessary measures, as I have said, to remove obstructions and restore navigation through the Suez Canal, and to promote a settlement of the problems in the area." There was a good deal of confusion regarding the government's decision to abstain when it came to the emergency force proposal. Hugh Gaitskell, the Labour Party leader, even felt compelled to ask, "Can we clarify a little more the attitude of Her Majesty's government to the International Force proposal?" Yet the matter was further complicated by the very question of the Suez Canal. Selwyn Lloyd claimed that the emergency force resolution must do more than merely keep Israel and Egypt apart. It must also protect the canal, as the British and French planned to do. By excluding the issue of the canal, the United Nations implied that the Egyptians could hold on to it as before, which to the British government remained unacceptable. Gaitskell was anxious to impress upon the Foreign Secretary what position this put Britain in, though, and how much of a villain she would appear to the wider world. Gaitskell said, "Is the Foreign Secretary aware that by imposing that particular implication, the effect is to confirm in the minds of the whole world that the real reason for British and French intervention here was not to separate the combatants, but to seize control of the canal? Is he further aware that if Her Majesty's government insists that the purpose of the international force under the United Nations must be to deal with the Suez Canal problem, they will effectively sabotage the whole idea of that force?" Indeed, of course, Selwyn Lloyd was aware of this, but now he was effectively playing for time. Before the evening of the 5th of November, when the Egyptians made plain their intentions to resist, it was far from certain that an emergency force would be needed at all. It would be better to try and delay this force where possible, and to trip it up on matters of the canal. This way, if the United Nations failed to account for the canal, then the British and French could stay and wrest the necessary concessions from Cairo. But if the United Nations did manage to create a resolution for the canal, then it would be out of President Nasser's hands, and Eden would have something to point to as the fruits of his labours. This straightforward equation, of course, does not account for the cuttingly bad press which Britain would endure in the meantime, which was what Gaitskell was referring to. The cynicism in British foreign policy and its naked self-interest could no longer be hidden. If it was clear to the leader of the Labour Party that Eden's government was using the canal to slow matters down, then it would certainly be clear to the Americans as well. Gaitskell then did some of our work for us when he asked Lloyd, "Is the Foreign Secretary aware that it is vitally important to distinguish between the setting up of an international force to deal with the Arab-Israeli question and an international force to impose on Egypt a solution of the Suez Canal problem? Does the Foreign Secretary realise that it is because I feel that this distinction is vital that I am pressing the difference between the two proposals?" Indeed, Lloyd was not aware, or if he was, he did not admit to being so. Instead, he began with a lie, insisting that "there is no question of imposing a settlement," when imposing a settlement was exactly what the British and French were trying to do to Egypt. Lloyd then added, "I should have thought that every sensible person would have agreed that these things, having happened, it was wiser that there should be a settlement of all those matters, that being the Suez Canal and an Israeli-Egyptian ceasefire, before the international policemen were removed." After some more fiery rhetoric, including damaging exposés where the transcripts of British broadcasts to Egyptians were read, underlining the fact that Britain was at war with Egypt in all but name, Anthony Eden then jumped in to rescue his embattled Foreign Secretary with some news. This news was to the effect that, "I think that the House would wish to know that I have had a flash signal from the Commander-in-Chief in the Eastern Mediterranean, which affects even the discussion which is now taking place. That is why I intervened, as I know the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Leader of the Opposition, will understand. This is the flash signal, which is, of course, subject to confirmation. It reads, Governor and Military Commander, Port Said now discussing surrender terms. Ceasefire ordered." Cheers and hollers followed Eden's announcement, as the relieved faces of the Conservatives told several tales. It had been a close-run thing, but now a ceasefire had been ordered in Egypt, and on British terms, for sure. Yet, Eden had jumped the gun. Only later in the evening would the Prime Minister find out that no ceasefire had been agreed to at all, and only preliminary talks had taken place. Eden's false flag had created one of the most impassioned reactions among his backbenchers that he had seen since Victory in Europe Day, but he would soon have to retract this statement altogether. thousands of miles from this historic House of Commons meeting, the reality of the Egyptian situation was playing itself out. It was at Port Said on the day of the 5th of November that the Anglo-French paratroopers battled the Egyptians, on the expectation that they should fold and capitulate, throwing Nasser under the bus in the process. According to the original plan, if the Egyptians did not buckle under the combined pressures, then the armed forces of both powers, waiting only a few miles out at sea, would be landed the next morning on the 6th of November. Eden, we'll recall, had banked much on the expectation that the Egyptians would fold at the first encounter with the Anglo-French elite. Back in the Commons, and informed by the Commander-in-Chief that ceasefire talks were ongoing, with orders to make that ceasefire happen, it seemed only natural for Eden to expect that the next phase of his plan would be followed, and a ceasefire favourable to Britain would be his. This he could wave in front of the Commons to prove that he had been right all along, and the British forces would of course then stand down and allow the United Nations Emergency Force into the country to replace them. As per the terms of this hypothetical peace treaty, Eden expected the Suez Canal to be back in Anglo-French hands as well. On all of these breathtakingly naive accounts, the British Foreign Minister was to be disappointed, but he didn't know this in the early evening of the 5th of November. The stormy and angry scenes in the Commons, and the gauntlets laid down by the Labour Party leader above all, inflicted untold damage on Eden's image of control. He was evidently not in control of the situation. His peers, both behind him in the benches and across in opposition, were sick of being uninformed. They were sick of reading the scandalous contents of a leaflet alleged to have been dropped on the Egyptians, or the transcript of a radio broadcast which the Egyptians had heard. Only for the Foreign Secretary, Selwyn Lloyd, to say that he had never heard, read, or approved of such acts. How did the left hand not know what the right hand was doing to such an extent? Britain had been painted as the enemy of peace under Eden's leadership. Her representatives in the United Nations had several times voted against measures which would have brought about peace, on the understanding that they somehow knew better. Whatever the latent leftover legacy of world power status, the United Nations had always been Anthony Eden's pride and joy. He had vouched for it and enthusiastically supported it in the immediate post-war years as a means of uniting the West against tyranny and protecting the national interest together. During this time, he had forged important relationships and crafted a picture of British governance as sensible and patient, as considerate and as willing to defer to the United Nations in order to get things done. In many respects, Lester Pearson's United Nations Emergency Force solution should have been Eden's. The Eden of 20 years before could well have proposed it to keep peace between Nazi Germany and the rest of Europe, had there been a United Nations to speak of at that point in time. There are also parallels between what Eden pushed relentlessly for here and what Benjamin Disraeli, the old British Prime Minister, tried to push for in the late 1870s. In both of these cases, the Prime Ministers attempted to pursue a radical policy line against increasing odds. If we'll recall in the 1870s, covered in our Britain Goes to War series, Disraeli went against the grain to redefine British conservative foreign policy in a manner which characterised Toryism all the way up to the outbreak of the First World War and beyond. But Anthony Eden, try as he might, could not redefine anything. He was not the calibre of statesman which the decades of experience should have moulded him into, and he approached the premiership in possession of a profound inferiority complex, the result of coming after a giant like Churchill. Ironically, while Disraeli did not have his war with Russia in the 1870s, he still managed to leave an indelible mark upon British politics and policy. Eden, on the other hand, did get his war, but the same cannot be said for his political legacy. If this judgment from my part seems a bit harsh, then it is difficult to be generous to a man who only had to toe a certain line and plug himself into the prevailing political mood of the time in order to succeed, rather than embrace an obsolete worldview in an era which was rapidly leaving Britain behind. Britain didn't need to be a first-rate power, and Eden must have known that it was impossible to aim this high. Yet still, the Prime Minister pushed for a conflict which few outside his immediate circle wanted or even understood, and he pursued relentlessly the figure of Nasser out of vanity and a sense of hurt pride. Nasser, this Egyptian, this native, this Arab, had gotten the better of Eden and embarrassed him too many times. Because Eden was so insecure to begin with, Nasser was always bound to get under his skin, and thanks to the stunted manner with which Eden wielded the Conservative Party, the Suez Canal was always going to become a Suez crisis. It is somewhat nostalgic, but also tragic, to watch The Darkest Hour, and to see Gary Oldman's Churchill rely so heavily on Anthony Eden, who he referred to throughout the film as simply Anthony. Anthony Eden had made a career out of opposing tyranny in Europe, and he had made his name by resigning rather than stand for the kind of spineless lack of direction which British foreign policy in the late 1930s represented. Eden was a good, solid character in many respects, but it does seem as though his war experience represented the better part of his career. While he relished Churchill's friendship and his praise, and while he felt immensely proud to succeed the man who was in many respects his political mentor and ideological equal, Eden was never, ever able to escape Winston Churchill's shadow. And because the comparisons to what Churchill would have done were never far behind him from spring 1955, Eden never seemed to possess enough confidence to step out on his own and forge ahead with a new policy in conservatism. Instead, Eden offered more of the same when it came to Tory foreign policy, yet this more of the same was also tinged with an insecurity and sensitivity which meant that the new Prime Minister took things too personally and that he surrounded himself with yes-men rather than share the load, or share the information for that matter, among the Cabinet, the Government or the Administration. This led to a repeat of scenes we've already seen, where the legal officers, tasked with advising the British Foreign Office, were kept so in the dark that they didn't even know what to do with themselves, and they then found they couldn't abide by this direction in policy when they did learn of its truths. It also meant that Eden's policy was liable to be ripped apart by the political opposition, be it in the Commons, or more damagingly still, over the radio for all to hear. Finally, of course, Eden's style meant that he first rubbed people the wrong way, and then he deeply angered and offended them. One of these figures who was just so offended was a man whom Eden still naively believed was his friend, Dwight D. Eisenhower, the President of the United States. It seemed impossible to Eisenhower that Eden could so have bungled British foreign policy, to the point that the Soviets had managed to breeze into Hungary while all the world was focused on Suez. You might remember back many episodes ago to the first part of 1956, and that scene where the war correspondents had left Budapest in droves because, in their view from late October, the story there was over and the new story was unfolding in Egypt. This scene is a great metaphor for the public perception of what was going on in Hungary. Considering the oft-parted importance which Suez held to British interests, it was understandably difficult for the average British citizen to keep pace with, or at least invest additional emotional weight into, events taking place in an East European city. Had Suez not flared up when it did, it is likely that Khrushchev would still have ordered the tanks into Budapest, since he had felt, as we saw, that he had no choice. However, if Khrushchev had chosen to topple Imre Nagy's government without any other crisis in the world to distract from this act, we imagine that the political and diplomatic complications and consequences for the Soviets and Khrushchev in particular would have been a lot more serious. The American president couldn't bring himself to believe that his British peer had handed such a perfect opportunity to the Soviets. Here was one of the clearest examples of British imperialism pulling resources and attentions away from more critical theatres at just the wrong time. Eisenhower's anger must have been palpable when we consider that Khrushchev's secret speech had been viewed as a kind of turning of the corner for Soviet government, and the departure of Hungary from the Soviet bloc seemed to indicate that Soviet power, if not on the decline, was certainly not as steely as Moscow liked to pretend. This, of course, was the major reason why the Soviets re-intervened in Budapest in the first place. Short of every other flimsy excuse that they offered, the exit of Hungary from the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet bloc made the Kremlin look very weak and foolish indeed. In an effort to recoup his prestige, Khrushchev ordered the tanks into Budapest. It was a line of thinking that would not have been alien to Anthony Eden, who was also fighting for prestige himself. Now it seemed that the Anglo-French and Soviets had thrown caution to the wind and struck out in the name of old-fashioned pursuits which could only result in war. The most visible manifestation of the world's Suez distraction was the utter clogging of the United Nations, where the Secretary-General, Dag Hammarskjöld, worked well into the night for the first fortnight of November in order to get through the workload, and he was still consistently behind the times. There was just too much for everyone to do and talk through. An emergency force had to be developed and sent to Egypt. A proper ceasefire with lasting effect had to be arranged between the Egyptians and Israelis. And the Suez Canal debacle would also require a solution. All of these issues had the potential to heighten tempers, and even before the eruption of the Soviet invasion of Hungary in the early hours of the 4th of November, tensions had been high and everyone was worn out from the constant all-night sessions that were required to sift through all the paperwork, to lobby the necessary votes, and, of course, climb carefully over the bloated egos to reach some kind of Egyptian solution. And Eisenhower's problems were compounded by three additional factors. First, John Foster Dulles, who had long complained of stomach pains in the previous weeks, was rushed to hospital on the 3rd of November with suspected appendicitis, which turned out to be colon cancer. Dulles would be down for months for surgery and recuperation, and Dulles's replacement was Herbert Hoover Jr., son of that president who in the 1950s was an American oil baron and who also happened to be the Undersecretary of State for Foreign Affairs. Hoover had extensive interests in the Middle East for personal business reasons, and he took it as a personal affront that the British and French wished to take some of these important assets for themselves. In the constant oil wars which waged in the background of political niceties, men like Herbert Hoover administered their oil business while also attending to political responsibilities, and they were often able to merge the two parts of their lives for their own convenience. Hoover was skilled in negotiation, but Eisenhower knew that he lacked the patience for the worn-out arguments of Britain and France that the tactful Dulles had held. This meant, from the 3rd of November, Anglo-American and Franco-American diplomacy was in danger of drifting apart. The second, more immediate problem to Eisenhower concerned that of a political nature. On the 7th of November, merely days away, Americans would go to the polls and decide whether they wanted Eisenhower to stay on for another term or not. In the end, they decided that they liked Ike very much indeed, but this could not have been certain in the heady days before the 7th of November. A politician through and through, Eisenhower had been counting down to that day for some time, and he had planned several campaign trails around it. Yet in the two-week period before his re-election, everything seemed to fall apart, with revolution in Hungary and crisis in Egypt pulling his energies and resources away. As the hours ticked closer to the election and he grew more nervous, Eisenhower also grew more irritable out of the fear that Eden's policy could cost him the presidency, since it could highlight American foreign policy as paralyzed just at the moment when the president was exclaiming his plans for a tougher line towards communism. Finally, Eisenhower's third problem was related to a profound distrust of Soviet policy and a fear that this moment, in early November 1956, potentially held all the ingredients for a third world war. Soviet aggression in Hungary, twinned with Western inaction and distraction, painted a frightful combination. One of Eisenhower's advisors later remembered that discussions in the Oval Office remained somber and focused on the threat level emanating from Moscow. His advisor continued, "No stern and indignant rhetoric could make the moment less perilous, less precarious, for the obvious danger existed that Moscow might be irresistibly tempted towards aggressive action on a massive scale by both hope and fear, the hope that Egypt signified a deep division in the West, and the fear that Hungary threatened a kind of earthquake within the Soviet sphere. The combination looked explosive, and the president described it pithily. Those boys are both furious and scared. Just as with Hitler, that makes for the most dangerous possible state of mind, and we better be damn sure that every intelligence point and every outpost of our armed forces is absolutely right on their toes." Eisenhower had just lost Dulles, a keen friend and mind in these crisis-filled times, so the president's gloom is easy to understand. Dulles would normally be the one to calm or reason with Eisenhower and to search for an alternative approach. By the 5th of November, though, Eisenhower had yet to find a new approach. The Anglo-French were clearly stalling in the United Nations, an armed intervention was being launched by the Soviets against Hungary, and Anglo-French paratroopers landed in Egypt earlier in the day. What Eisenhower may not have known was the basis for a telegram from London which soon reached him. This was the first of several messages which Eden was to send to Washington and across the world, in a bid to recast British intervention in Egypt as a noble act, one which had been done for the benefit of the United Nations and for stability. It was one of these letters which arrived on Eisenhower's desk then, just as he was tying himself in knots and doing his very best not to aggravate his heart. Eden's letter read thus: "I am convinced that if we had allowed things to drift, everything would have gone from bad to worse. Nasser would have become a kind of Muslim Mussolini, and our friends in Iraq, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and even Iran would have gradually been brought down. We and the French were convinced that we had to act at once to forestall a general conflagration throughout the Middle East, and now that police action has been started, it must be carried through. You will have realized, with all your experience, that we cannot have a military vacuum while a UN force is being constituted and being transported to the spot. That is why we feel we must go on to hold the position until we can hand over responsibility to the United Nations. This, in its turn, will reduce the threat to the canal and restore it to the general use of the world. By this means, we shall have taken the first steps towards re-establishing authority in this area for our generation." Eisenhower may well have asked in response, re-establishing the authority of whom? Did Eden mean the British Empire? Or did he simply refer to an Egyptian government which would respond to British commands? Perhaps the Prime Minister meant an international body taking the form of the authority. Yet, as we said, Eisenhower was a politician, and he would have recognized in this letter here an early attempt by Eden to save face by recasting Britain and France as peacekeepers, intercepting the role of the United Nations and filling in for that noble body when the able-bodied men were not at that point available. Rather than ask questions about the contents, Eisenhower would instead have wondered what had brought this change in approach. The reason why Eden was now painting the Anglo-French Act as something of a holding action in Suez was because the Prime Minister had recently received some bad news. This news, which we have alluded to before, revolved around the fact that the Egyptians would not be making an unconditional surrender under any circumstances, and with this in mind, it was time to work to ensure that whatever happened next, Britain and France were sufficiently insulated to not have to worry about the fallout in public relations. The British and French would probably have to fight Nasser to obtain the ceasefire agreement that they wanted, but they would have to make sure that their war and search for a regime change still appeared like a noble exercise. Eden was here fashioning an excuse which could be used by British policymakers to explain why Operation Musketeer was about to be put into motion. Early the next morning, on the 6th of November, the Anglo-French paratroopers were joined by their thousands of peers. Equipment, ammunition, military vehicles, and countless soldiers poured into Egypt through Port Said. The Suez Crisis, at the moment when Eisenhower's political fortunes were at stake, and the people of Budapest were fighting for their very lives, had become a Suez War. Next time, we'll resume our story and explain how the Anglo-French forces were destined to fight only for a day, thanks to some severe pressures levelled at the now squirming British Prime Minister. I hope you'll join me for that, but until next time, history friends and lovely patrons all, my name is Zach, and this has been 1956, The Suez Crisis, Episode 2. 0.17. Thanks for listening. I'll be seeing you all next week.